China's carbon dioxide emissions are growing much faster than expected. They're on pace to double during this decade. Forecasts of global warming don't take that growth into account. And as NPR's Richard Harris reports, that means scientists may be underestimating how fast the planet will heat up.
When scientists last tried to project China's contribution to global warming, it was the late 1990s. Asia was in a recession, and China's emissions weren't growing all that fast. Maximilian Aufhammer at the University of California at Berkeley says things have changed radically since then.
What we've observed since 2000 is that growth in CO2 emissions has been really off the charts, is probably the right word to say it.
For example, in 2004, emissions from China grew by 14%. That's so fast, it's as though the world suddenly had another Germany or England appear from out of nowhere, smokestacks and tailpipes belching full bore. Aufhammer and a colleague have used detailed information from within China to get an idea about what emissions will be like through the end of the decade.
The average of all these scenarios predicts continued growth in emissions of about 10 to 11% a year, which is roughly what we've observed over the last 4 years of our sample.
So that's doubling every decade.
Yeah. It's a very large number.
His forecast is being published in the Journal of Environmental Economics and Management. By this reckoning, China overtook the United States as the leading emitter of carbon dioxide about a year ago, and its emissions are now increasing about 10 times faster than ours. That also means that carbon dioxide is building up in the atmosphere a lot faster than the United Nations Science Panel, the IPCC, figured in its big report last year.
We have to realize that these scenarios rely on data that are something like 12 years old.
The analyses that were done, say, 5 or 6 years ago, no one could have anticipated the growth rates in energy use and CO2 emissions from China.
Greg Marlin works at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory, which compiles emission figures from around the world. He says economists are now starting to update their forecasts, knowing that more rapid increases in emissions mean more rapid global warming. But Marlin says it's a mistake to look at China in isolation.
Basically, a significant fraction of emissions from China are to produce goods that will be consumed in the United States. So it's wrong, I think, to point fingers at individuals or individual countries. We have to recognize that we're all in this together.
And China isn't just ignoring the issue. The country's economy is growing very rapidly as it struggles to bring a large percentage of its population out of poverty. Debbie Seligson, who works for the World Resources Institute in Beijing, says in the past few years, China has instituted policies to slow emissions growth. So China might end the decade better than scientists are currently forecasting.
What happens is a complex mix of sort of business behavior, policy behavior, financial behavior.
But Max Aufhammer from Berkeley says even if China does slow its emissions, the recent building boom in coal-fired power plants will have repercussions for decades to come.
If I build a coal-fired power plant today, that may be in operation for somewhere between 40 and 80 years. Any policy now is not going to tear down existing costly capital equipment in China, but we should really worry about what the next power plant they put in next week and the week after is going to be.
Aufhammer says he's an optimist, so he doesn't see this as a hopeless task, but he does say everyone's going to have to step up. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Medical blogs have drawn back the curtain on the inner workings of the medical profession. Online readers can learn about the latest medical gadgets, read physicians' views on healthcare issues, even get a peek at the inner thoughts of surgeons. Despite their attraction, though, these blogs have raised concerns about privacy issues on the web. Deirdre Kennedy of member station KQED reports.
Take a stroll through any of the 120,000 healthcare blogs online, and you can find opinions on everything from popular pharmaceuticals to celebrity skin problems. There's no precise figures on how many physician blogs are out there, but they're easy to find. There's EM Physician, which recounts a horror story about gangsters with severe burns. There's Aggravated Doc Search, which admits that operations are fun to do. And there's Radiology Picture of the Day. One doctor who draws about 12,000 readers a day is New Hampshire internist Dr. Kevin Foe. His blog, Kevin MD, offers a doctor's eye view on medical issues that appeal to both his peers and the public.
I talk a lot about primary care because there is a myriad of problems that I, as a primary care physician, face that I want to communicate to the public. I talk about malpractice and how physicians practice defensive medicine to avoid malpractice lawsuits. Pretty much every hot health topic that comes up.
Foe's blog has turned him into something of a celebrity in the blogosphere. Blogging can be a great marketing tool for raising a physician's profile and attracting new patients, says healthcare marketing expert Farid Janmar.
Patients who see physicians who blog realize that these physicians understand, I think, implicitly that patients are hungry for information and that by providing this information, sometimes they will become much more trusted by patients because they believe that they're going to be much more responsive.
But not all physician blogs seem geared towards marketing. In fact, just the opposite is the case of some extremely candid blogs like White Coat Rants, Cancer Doc, and MDOD, which bills itself as random thoughts from a few cantankerous American physicians. These are more like diaries in which doctors vent about reimbursement rates, difficult cases, and what a, quote, bummer it is to have so many patients die. Dr. Deborah Peel, a psychiatrist and founder of Patient Privacy Rights, thinks physician blogs often step too close to the limits of patient privacy.
The problem with physicians blogging about patients is absolutely the danger that that person will be able to identify themselves or that others that know them will be able to identify them. That's just horrendous.
Peel's group is concerned that information about a patient's case can be traced back to the individual and adversely affect their employment, their health insurance, or other aspects of their life. Certainly, if a doctor violates patients' privacy, there could be legal consequences. Under the federal HIPAA laws, physicians could face fines, even jail time. And in some states, patients can file a civil lawsuit if they believe a doctor has violated their privacy. Still, for psychoanalyst Dr. Deborah Peel, it's not just privacy issues that trouble her.
If you are unhappy with the people that you're supposed to be serving and taking care of, you probably need therapy. You know, you don't need to be venting your frustrations in a public manner like that. I mean, that's very inappropriate and unprofessional.
You might say we as doctors should never be talking about experiences with our patients online or in books or in articles.
Dr. Robert Wachter is author of a blog called Wachter's World. As a leading expert on patient safety, he writes extensively about medical mistakes. He says it's important for doctors to be able to share about cases as long as they change the facts substantially. But he says that's one reason patients shouldn't take all of the information on blogs at face value.
We do learn from each other as we talk about stories and the way we dealt with certain complex situations. And yes, it means that from a patient standpoint, or even from another doctor standpoint, you can't really know exactly what facts have been changed in order to preserve patient privacy.
Wachter says, taken for what they are, unedited opinions, and in some cases entertainment, blogs can give readers some useful insight into the good, the bad, and the ugly of the medical profession. For NPR News, I'm Deirdre Kennedy.
This is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. The salmon fishing season in Oregon and California could be over before it starts. Regulators meeting in Sacramento today are expected to recommend severe fishing restrictions. Tamara Keith of member station KQED reports.
Populations of Fall Run Chinook salmon in the Sacramento River are projected to fall to an all-time low this year. So low that even if no salmon are caught, biologists say the number of adult fish returning to the river to spawn will be less than half of what's needed to sustain the run.
It's bad. It's unprecedented in how bad it is, in fact.
Donald McIsaac is executive director of the Pacific Fishery Management Council, the group charged with managing ocean fisheries off the West Coast. It already shut down early season fishing. Now, McIsaac says, the council is working up three possible recommendations for the rest of the season. Two would allow what he describes as skimpy fishing in a few areas. The third is what most huddled at this Sacramento hotel seem to believe is going to happen.
Complete closure of all sport and commercial salmon fishing south of Cape Falcon, which is way up north end of Oregon. So most of Oregon and all of California completely closed.
The last crisis in the West Coast salmon fishery came 2 years ago when the Klamath River fish population collapsed. This time the Klamath is doing better. But the problem is, once Sacramento River salmon get to the ocean, they get around. Ben Platt, a fisherman from Fort Bragg, says Sacramento River fish sustain the entire California and Oregon salmon industry.
I mean, Sacramento fish are caught all the way up through Canada. So these fish go everywhere. And that's why they won't let us fish, even though there's other healthy runs that we could fish on. All these fish swim together, so if you catch Klamath fish, you're going to be catching Sacramento fish too.
And if you catch too many Sacramento fish, when they're so scarce, there won't be enough coming back to the river to spawn in the fall. Platt comes from a family of commercial fishermen. He's tattooed and weather-worn. He says without salmon this year, he's out of options as a fisherman.
So I'm looking at basically 5 months of no viable income. I can fish for a little black cod. I can keep trying to catch crab. But none of it's going to replace my salmon income.
In past years, fishermen have had harsh words for regulators. This year, though, there seems to be a sense of resignation. Duncan McLean represents the salmon industry to the council. He's a lifelong fisherman, too.
What am I going to do? Advocate the extinction of a species or advocate the preservation of it? It's pretty much a no-brainer.
The council will make a final decision next month. But those in the West Coast salmon fishing industry are already calling for federal disaster assistance. The economic effects could be felt at dinner tables thousands of miles away. For NPR News, I'm Tamara Keith in Sacramento.
And finally today, we couldn't resist ripping this next story directly from the pages of the New York Times. The headline, An Enduring Measure of Fitness, The Simple Push-Up. After reading the article, I learned that a 40-year-old woman should be able to do 16 push-ups and a 40-year-old man 27 to prove that they're in good physical condition. Day-to-Day host Alex Chadwick has been on vacation this week, but he's here now by phone from his house. Hi, Alex.
Madeline, how nice of you to call me for this story.
Okay, how many push-ups do you think you can do?
I'm not sure, actually.
Well, get down. Drop and give me 10.
10. Okay, yeah. Hold on just a second.
Okay.
Ready?
Uh-huh.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay.
How you doing?
Good.
Can you keep going?
Oh, yeah.
Go on. Okay, right. Alex, I don't want you to have a heart attack there. I want you to come back and host on Monday.
Hey.
Okay, come back. Come back to me.
I'll see you Monday if I'm recovered.
How many was that?
30.
30? Yeah, and you're over 40.
I'm a little over 40, yeah.
Yeah, just by a whisper. You know, Alex, though, there's a 93-year-old man who can do his fair share of push-ups.
A 93-year-old man mm-hmm. who does push-ups?
Yeah.
Who would that be?
That's Jack LaLanne, the Jack LaLanne, fitness guru, juicing fanatic, and push-up king. And, Alex, he's still preaching good health in his one-piece warm-up suit with his 82-year-old wife, Elaine.
Elaine LaLanne?
Elaine LaLanne. I called them up yesterday, and we talked push-ups. How many push-ups can you do?
None of your business. I do a lot. I work out 2 hours every day. You know, I broke the world's record in push-ups. Yeah. I did 1,000 chins and 1,000 push-ups in an hour and 20 minutes.
Yeah, on the Art Baker show, he did it. You know, I was able to, Jack got me into push-ups when I was younger, and I was able to do 50 push-ups.
Tell them about Regis Philbin. We were in the Regis Philbin show.
This was many, many years ago.
And Regis, uh-huh. You know, he's kind of proud of his physical prowess, so he got down and he did 25 push-ups.
I did 26.
And Elaine got down and did 26. That hurt his ego.
But
you know, I was on television 34 years.
Yeah, I remember.
The longest running health and fitness show in the history.
I remember.
And the first one.
I was on a show called The Les Molloy Show. It was an hour and a half every day from 4:30 to 6. I got a call from Oakland, California, and they said, oh, we got this guy who can do push-ups for your whole show. I thought, yeah, well, that'd be great. We'll pan over to him. And he did. He did push-ups through the whole hour and a half show.
The whole time?
The whole time. Yeah.
I'm nuts.
That's how I met him, doing push-ups.
Well, it has been such a pleasure speaking to you both. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Madeline. It's
you know,
really
we're
nice
very flattered
you.
And honored that a young sex goddess like you want to talk to we folks. Do you work out a little bit?
I sure do.
That a girl.
Now he wants to interview you, Madeline.
Are you married or happy?
Both, I think.
In And don't lose your sense of humor. Have fun.
It's been a
roller coaster ride with him all these years.
You tell all the ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, that anything in life is possible if you make it happen. And God helps them that help themselves. I hope and pray you help the most important person on this earth, you.
Jack and Elaine LaLanne, thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Thank you, dear.
Well, Madeline, as you are my witness, I did 40 push-ups.
I know. I am really, really impressed. And I'm just going to say I'm going to have some practicing to do. Day to Day is a production of NPR News with Slate.com. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Have a great weekend.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Today in Your Health, long-term care insurance. It has expanded over the past 20 years from insurance coverage for nursing home care to insurance that will pay for help in your own home. Insurance companies are marketing their product to baby boomers. Yeah, that's you or somebody you know, all those millions of Americans hurtling toward retirement. But according to a number of surveys, baby boomers are not listening to the insurance companies. NPR's Patty Naiman does this report.
Bill Vaughn sits in his office surrounded by piles of papers filled with research and statistics about all kinds of consumer health issues. As a policy analyst with Consumers Union, the group which publishes Consumer Reports magazine, Vaughn's considered an expert when it comes to health care issues. But when he looks at long-term care insurance, like most Americans of about the same vintage, he resists.
This is the last thing you want to buy. You want to plan for a vacation trip or something. And to buy long-term care insurance policy is a chore, and it's it brings up images of the end of the road and eventually death. And so it's not a product that you go joyfully out buying, and we keep putting it off.
That's pretty typical, according to Greg Seal, a financial planner who runs his own company in Denver, Colorado. Seal says boomers are skeptical about long-term care insurance, not only for emotional reasons, but also for practical ones.
Baby boomers are carrying a lot more debt today than their parents did at the ages that they are. And so they're paying for more of that, and they don't have enough resources to fund this risk.
The actual risk of needing some kind of long-term care is high. Two-thirds of seniors will need it at some point in their lives, but mostly they'll need it only for short periods. One-fourth use long-term care for one or more years. So for a healthy person in their mid-50s, is long-term care insurance worth it? That's a question Joel Gold wanted to answer. Gold is a professor of finance at the University of Southern Maine, as well as a financial planner. Gold looked at the cost of care. He factored in the probability of needing that care, and here's what he found.
Long-term care insurance is desirable for women at any age, and it is desirable for younger to middle-aged males.
So why such boomer resistance? Financial analyst Greg Seal says boomers often are mistaken and think Medicare will cover long-term care costs, but it won't. Medicare pays for short-term medical care at home or for a limited stay in a nursing home, but only after a hospitalization. And actually, buying long-term care insurance is not simple in our fast-changing healthcare industry. On top of that is the biggest unknown. Will the insurance you buy today pay for the kind of care that might be available in the future? Mila Kaufman is a policy analyst with Georgetown University.
No one really knows what we'll have in 30 to 40 years from now. For instance, in the 70s, when long-term care insurance was first sold, most of the care was provided in nursing home settings. Back then, no one could envision that we would have assisted living and people being able to live at home and get care and help at home.
So Kaufman says a 50-year-old might buy long-term care insurance today that, say, pays for assisted living. But 30 years down the road, something better might come along, some sort of video or robotic monitoring, for instance, something your policy wouldn't even envision today. Patty Naiman, NPR News.
This is Day to Day. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Madeline Brand. One in four teenage girls is infected with a sexually transmitted disease. That's according to a new Centers for Disease Control study. And also according to that study, half of all African-American girls have an STD. With us now is Dr. Kevin Fenton of the CDC. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
25% of all teenage girls, that seems really high.
Well, you know, when you consider that every year in the United States, there are more than 19 million new diagnoses of sexually transmitted diseases which are made across the country, and nearly half of these are in young adults aged under 25, it really is not that surprising.
What are the diseases?
Well, in this study specifically, we looked at four of the most common sexually transmitted diseases: human papillomavirus, or HPV, chlamydia, herpes simplex virus, and trichomoniasis. And these infectious diseases, or these STDs, were a cluster of diseases that we looked at to see how common it was for adolescent women to have at least one of them between the ages of 14 to 19.
And HPV, now you can get a vaccine to protect you.
That's right. And it's really one of the most effective vaccines that we have on the market for the prevention of any infectious disease. But specifically, it's quite effective in preventing both genital warts as well as cervical cancer.
So one in four teenage girls is infected. Half of African-American girls have an STD.
That's right. So in this study, nearly half or one in two of the African-American adolescents reported having one of the four STDs which they were tested for.
And how do you account for that?
We know that the societal and social context which affect the lives of many minority communities in the United States really have a tremendous impact on driving these STDs. Some of these factors, for example, include poor access to health services or poor quality health services, especially in urban or in rural parts of the country. And this is a major driving factor for some of the disparities we see. We also know that there are also societal factors, for example, poor housing, poverty, difficulties with socioeconomic status, high rates of incarceration. These are all factors in the society which can facilitate risky behaviors or risky mixing patterns within the population that also results in high rates of disease in some population groups.
Any data on boys and their STDs?
This study did not specifically address teenage boys or adolescent boys, but we have done other studies looking at STDs within young males and male adolescents. And in general, what we find as a whole are you tend to see lower rates of STDs or diagnoses among young boys, in part because of the different patterns of sexual mixing in the population. Young boys are more likely to have sexual relations with girls in the same age group, whereas adolescent girls tend to have slightly older male partners. And this difference in the patterns of sexual mixing often results in different transmission dynamics for the STDs.
These numbers, 25%, they seem high. Is this higher than previous studies that you've done on this, or is it in keeping?
It's in keeping. In previous studies which have been done, what we've actually looked at are individual sexually transmitted diseases and looked at the prevalence of these diseases in the population. For this study, we grouped these diseases as a cluster, so we're able to see the likelihood of acquiring any one of these four infectious diseases in the cluster. So this is the first time we're presenting the data in this format, but we have published other prevalent studies of the individual STDs in the past.
And can you also take away from the study the fact that teenagers are not using condoms as much as they should?
Absolutely. I think there are a number of things that we can take away from this study. First of all, the need for better education and open and honest conversations with our young people about sex, relationships, healthy relationships, and lifestyles, which can really protect them for their future sexual lives and sexual careers.
We've been talking about a new CDC study that says one in four teenage girls is infected with a sexually transmitted disease. Dr. Kevin Fenton of the CDC, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We adults may be surprised to hear that so many teenage girls have sexually transmitted disease, but what do teenagers think about this? We asked a group from Youth Radio to sit down to talk about it. 16-year-old Asha Richardson begins the conversation.
It's one of those things that's shocking but not extremely surprising. Because of, like, some girls that I know specifically, they've made really, like, not wise decisions, in my opinion, dating somebody that has multiple other partners. And then a lot of people, they're intimate with people without really getting to know them. And so people are just really uninformed.
This is Susanna Vong, and I'm 17. I mean, if you listen to the radio now, most of the hip-hop songs are all about dudes have to have a lot of women to be cool, and girls, they're just supposedly passive. It's based on these images that I feel like girls act kind of stupid.
Like with unprotected sex, a lot of girls, they want to feel loved and think, oh, well, he'll love me if I do this.
Hi, I'm Brandon Robbins and I'm 17. People decide to have unprotected sex because a lot of people think that it won't happen to them. They look at a person and say, oh, they don't look like they have nothing. Well, I had this friend, right, and, you know, he's a macho type of person. He's out there. You know, he's trying to talk to every girl. He found this one girl who he wanted to make his girlfriend. And, well, people thought she had HIV, but he actually slept with her. And we told him he should get a test, and he had got the test results back. And he came to my house, and he was, like, weeping, kind of, like, sad, crying. And he said he had full-blown AIDS. It definitely shaped mine up, my reality of the world up, because when you hear about it, you don't actually care until something happened to one of your friends. Since that happened, a lot of my friends try to stay celibate because they're afraid of what might happen to them. Adults gotta instill values in your child. My mom always told me if I had anything to talk to her about, just come up to her and talk to her. When I first started talking to her about certain stuff, she would talk to me on a friend point of view. She would talk to me, but then when it's time to share some knowledge toward me, she'd speak to me like an elder, my mother.
I think girls care about being pregnant because they can see other girls around them that are around their age that actually go through 9 months and then actually having to take care of a child, losing sleep, losing their education, all that. People with STDs, they don't talk about it much. So a lot of people don't understand that that can also ruin your life. I think that's the thing that people are most misinformed about. They don't see the pain, so they can't imagine themselves getting it because they don't see the pain that people go through.
That's Susanna Vong and other teens from Youth Radio talking about a new study that shows 1 in 4 teenage girls are infected with sexually transmitted disease.